5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Alcatraz, an island in the Bay of San Francisco that was once a fort, then a prison, then a tourist attraction, now draws more than 1.5 million visitors a year. They wait patiently in line on the San Francisco wharves, watch the sea lions do their daily layabout in the sun on any piling they can find, and then a boat arrives to take the visitors over to the island, which is only a mile away, visible from almost any point in the Golden Gate City. It's here that they get to do the oddball thing, really. They tour through what was once considered the most maximum of maximum security prisons in the country. They get to see where Al Capone lost his mind while there on tax evasion charges, and where excessively violent gangster and kidnapper Machine Gun Kelly was considered a model prisoner. They get to step into the regulation 8-foot by 5-foot prison cell where men lived out life sentences for barbaric crimes against humanity, a place nicknamed by them as Hellcatraz. Paying visitors get to be put in solitary confinement and then giggle or quietly freak when the lights are turned out for the merest of minutes, knowing that some men spent months, even years, down there in the dark. They get to ramble through the mess hall where, before a minor riot changed things, you could not speak unless it was to ask some fellow prisoner to pass the salt, though you had better not linger over discussions of the weather. You were punished for that, or for less. And the weather was worth talking about. It was forever damp and almost always cold, even in July. It's said that there were three seasons there: winter, summer, and October. Only the latter provided you with clear skies, gentle breezes, and a modicum of warmth. Otherwise, wind whistled and screeched as it relentlessly whipped through the old fortress. The fog was unforgivably heavy and limited the otherwise magnificent view of the city that was growing into its own brand of elegance and verve. Made by railroad money and shipping profit and gold rush millionaires, it would be the anchor for growth and industry in the rest of Northern California, which had already been blessed with so many natural gifts. Alcatraz had helped in that. It was, after all, the place where, in 1859, the first military fort and the first lighthouse were built on the West Coast. Later, it was where the American military's malingerers were sent and, to their credit, rehabilitated back into the military as successful soldiers almost 90% of the time. Not that the city loved the presence of Alcatraz ever. I mean, it was an ever-present sign that men needed locking away. A spin that scared civic leaders of the city, who worried the reputation would deter their dreams. Then, because crime grew in the rest of American cities in the mid-1930s, this is where the Bureau of American Prisons took over the island's fortress and decided it would house the baddest of the bad. According to Jolene Babiak, a renowned Alcatraz historian,
these are men who came there for their behavior, which meant they worked their ways up from the reform schools, the state prisons, the federal prisons, and ultimately to Alcatraz. They came there because of their behavior. They were long-term incarcerated men.
It was an unwritten rule that men were never really sent to Alcatraz straight away, that you had to first be a federal prisoner in, say, the pretty inhospitable Leavenworth. But you had tried to escape, or you were considered incorrigible or unmanageable or just too much trouble to put up with there. Then they'd ship you west, where Warden James A. Johnson had made it his goal to make the island inescapable. How does one do that exactly? Well, according to J. Campbell Bruce's Escape from Alcatraz, quote, "He erased the soft iron bars on most of the cells and the cell house windows with tool-proof steel. He installed automatic locking devices and tear gas outlets, gun galleries at either end of the cell house, and an outside gun walk along the south side of the mess hall. He put steel doors on the utility alley. He erected gun towers. He set gates with electric locks controlled by tower guards. He enclosed the entire prison area with a cyclone fence topped by barbed wire. He put bars on the sewer. He installed metal detectors about so that convicts would have to pass through them at least 8 times a day. End quote. Further, he installed microphones around the prison so guards could hear almost everything said. He ordered 12 counts of inmates a day, which expanded for some groups to 30 counts a day. If you worked in a shop, you were also counted every 15 minutes. He also improved the communication system to notify the Coast Guard and the city of San Francisco in case of prison breaks or riots. He demanded and got the best guard applicants. That is, he required sniper-quality marksmen who knew judo and were, at all times, combat-ready. Lastly, while other federal prisons had a 1-to-10 ratio of inmate to guard, at Alcatraz, it was 1-to-3. And yet, on the night of June 11, 1962, three convicted federal felons escaped from the Rock by taking to the open water in handmade rafts after 6 months of planning and prepping for the getaway. They were neither the first nor the last to attempt to escape the inescapable prison, but they are certainly the most famous. You can thank Clint Eastwood for that.
Years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
One, two, three, four, five, six. Six. Perfect number. I got six more bullets in my gun.
I'm required to bring up Clint Eastwood in this episode because the 1979 movie made about this escape in 1962 is said, by some, to have made Mr. Eastwood the legendary actor he is today. It was his first major role outside of a slew of what film buffs called spaghetti westerns, those fabulous, badass cowboy movies made in the 1960s by director Sergio Leone. You know those movies, Hang 'em High, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, For a Few Dollars More, and A Fistful of Dollars. Very good for Clint, but he was always, pardon me, film aficionados, playing the same guy, give or take a poncho. Escape from Alcatraz was his big breakout from that genre, and the film itself holds the distinction of being the first film ever made available for home rental. That, of course, is not what makes this crime one of our crimes of the centuries. That distinction is earned because it would be the leading reason, admitted to or not, that Alcatraz endured as a federal prison for a scant 9 more months. Now, some of you will note that the closure of the prison was in the works long before Frank Morris and the two Anglin brothers, Clarence and John, took their chances on the 50-degree shark-filled waters, strong currents, and the heavy chop of the San Francisco Bay. And yes, the plans to build a Marion, Illinois federal prison facility were well underway. It's equally true that Alcatraz cost more to run than any other federal prison at the time. According to reporting by the New York Times, in 1962, the cost of keeping a prisoner at Alcatraz, this includes guards, electricity, a diet of 3,600 calories a day in the mess hall, or 2,100 calories if you were in solitary, was $13.72 a day. At other federal prisons, that cost was an average of $5.37 a day. Let me do some today math to help us all get our heads around this. Each Alcatraz inmate was costing the American taxpayer a 2024 daily equivalent of $143.24, or the equivalent of what it costs to keep my middle schooler alive. But I haven't really done the math there, so don't quote me on it. And the average other federal prison? A bargain basement $56.07. So Alcatraz had some noted shortcomings. It's also true that its, clientele were no longer only the worst the country had to offer. At the time of the 1962 escape, author Bruce notes that there was an accountant there serving 5 years for tax evasion, another guy serving 10 years for car theft, a kid who had stolen a pig from a Native American reservation, and a military man there on assault charges. Oh, and for stealing $1.50. Yeah, but let's not get carried away. There also was the worst Boston offered the criminal world by way of Whitey Bulger. Regardless, Morris and the Anglins' escape had shined a very bright media light on Alcatraz's failings. So yes, plans to shutter it were in the books, but the escape sealed the deal, hurrying its demise along and implanting forever in the minds of Americans that with enough brains and patience, you could leave that island on your own terms. Maybe. Whether they did or didn't became one of the biggest mysteries of the century. It certainly added enormously to the allure of Alcatraz as a visitor destination, which now generates a considerable $60 million annually for the park system that could always use the money. Crime apparently does pay. Sorry. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. When Alcatraz was thriving, it was really thriving. And while it aspired to be the epitome of stern but fair incarceration, it never, ever aimed to rehabilitate. There was absolutely no effort made ever to turn the inmates into decent American citizens. Yes, they could take extension classes from the University of California if they themselves initiated the process. And yes, there were shops where inmates made gloves and brooms for industrial use, but no one was coming out of there with tools to be better humans. In 1938, Brian Conway, a former convict, wrote a piece for the Saturday Evening Post magazine that seemed to lay bare the truth about the institution early on. Conway reported that there were many suicide attempts inside of the prison, where the warden did not allow personal photos or pin-up girls to be affixed on cell walls. He added that in 1937, 14 prisoners had gone, quote-unquote, violently insane, and many others were isolated, termed stir-crazy. Some men, it seems, could not endure the unyielding, implacable torture of merciless and unwavering routine. During a three-year period in the 30s, J. Campbell Bruce reports 35 inmates left the Rock. Those nearly three dozen inmates who left headed for other federal prisons in straitjackets. One man who dealt with the stupefying boredom was Robert Stroud, a vicious killer who had been sentenced to a life in solitary confinement. Referred to those inside, even to the guards, as Mr. Stroud, he is known to the rest of us as the Birdman of Alcatraz, though a lot of his ornithological research on canaries was done when he was at Leavenworth. Stroud was allowed to continue his study of birds when he was sent to Alcatraz because a federal judge deemed it the work of his mind, something, he decided, we should never try to imprison. Anyway, when Frank Morris got to Alcatraz in January 1960, most of the worst regulations had been changed to reflect a less restrictive and brutal experience. Mail in and out was still heavily censored, including letters written to lawyers or judges that sometimes ended up never being mailed or read by those intended. But Olin Blackwell, who came to be warden in 1961, had followed the somewhat progressive work of other wardens who had done such things as allowing artwork on the walls in the cells, the keeping of musical instruments, permitting talking among the inmates, and encouraging them to read what the library at the facility had in terms of books and magazines. Inmates regularly gave blood to the San Francisco blood banks and were even allowed the use of radios at night to listen to ball games. Blackwell, I think kind of strangely, introduced knitting to the inmates. They had access to knitting needles and skeins of yarn, and soon enough, there was a doily and coverlet avalanche at Alcatraz. Blackwell also thought that providing the imprisoned with paints so they could express themselves artistically was a good idea. All they had to do was ask for the supplies. The 60s. Times were a-changin', I guess. Anyway, the reason why Morris, a bank robber and sometime burglar, had been sent from the federal prison in Atlanta to Alcatraz in 1960 was because of his repeated attempts to escape any jail facility he had ever been in. And the 34-year-old had been in a lot, first getting in trouble at 13, running away from foster homes and reformatory schools. In fact, he spent all but two of his adult years incarcerated. There's been a lot of discussion about exactly who was the mastermind of the 1962 escape. Alan West, who did not make it out because of, well, a technical error, claimed to the authorities that he was the one who first outlined the plan. He is also the one who told the FBI how the preparations had been conducted and how the plan was supposed to work. P.S., he got leniency for his helpfulness. Others, including most books and the Eastwood film, credit Morris as the likeliest investigator because, among other reasons, most of the inmates pointed him out as the smartest of the foursome. His nickname was, according to expert Babiak, Houdini. Truth was, those four weren't the only ones who relieved their boredom with plotting. And Beneath Alcatraz, a documentary about the escape, one former inmate said,
"It was a game that we played. We plotted escapes all the time."
Morris had had a troubled childhood. The fatherless son of a 17-year-old runaway, he was placed in foster care at 3. He was recalcitrant, yet pleasant when it served him. His mother visited him sporadically, but she was no picnic. She would tell him what she'd gotten him for Christmas, nuts and candy and fruit, but then she would reveal she'd eaten it all before she got to him. He didn't seem to mind when she stopped coming to visit him. He would tell law and prison authorities repeatedly that his parents had died in 1937. From the moment he got to Alcatraz, and hell, even before that, while he was on the short boat trip over from the mainland, Morris was plotting how to get off the island. He knew what the FBI knew, that from 1934 on, 36 men had tried 14 separate escapes. Most didn't get very far. The one pair did. Their names were Ralph Rowe and Theodore Cole, and on December 16, 1937, they managed to escape in broad daylight, cutting a hole in a shop window and managing to get down a length of fence without being noticed. From there, they appear to have used a tool they'd stolen from the shops they worked in and jimmied a gate lock and then leapt down to a beach 20 feet below them. And then they disappeared, likely into the water, using what law enforcement assumed were tires as floats. Nothing was found of them. They were determined to have died in the December Pacific, with the temperatures in the waters of San Francisco Bay being as low as 46 degrees. They had proved only one thing. You could get off this island. How long you would last after that was anybody's guess.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
While I was researching this case, something kept bugging me. The Morris you read about in most of the escape literature seems too smart to be such a lousy criminal. He'd pull off robberies, but somehow consistently get caught and put away. He never even really tried to go straight. If he was such a patient planner on how to beat the system, how come he never beat it? It seems to me if he'd been better at staying out of prison in the first place, he wouldn't have had to work so hard to find a way out. And if he was smart enough to figure out how to escape time and again, why wasn't he smart enough to avoid being captured? And I made myself dizzy trying to figure all this out. Because really, a lot of our fascination with this escape has to do with the creativity and diligence it took to work out the puzzle of deception and the freaking wherewithal to pull it off. It is nothing short of ingenious. And it took chutzpah. It may have even required some study. It's possible he learned a thing or two from the infamous Battle of Alcatraz, which lasted for 3 days in early May 1946, and was the result of an escape attempt gone awry. One of the pair trying to escape was supposed to go to court the following day on a writ of habeas corpus. He was likely to have been released, which begged the question, why the attempt? During the melee that ensued, 2 prison officials were killed, 14 others were injured. 3 inmates died, another was hurt. The 2 who would have done the fleeing were put to death in the gas chamber in 1948. What's my point? Morris knew the odds. He also knew the consequences. Still, he, or maybe it was West, but I'm going with Morris, cased the place from the moment he got there. He noticed everything, though later guards would say Morris never looked all that interested in what was going on around him. He had kind of a lackadaisical attitude, understood prison protocol, always asked permission, never forgot to do as he was told, never forgot the yes sir, no sir, okay sir life that he was bound to. Morris was assigned to cell 138 on Block B, also known as Broadway. I won't bore you with the prison architecture here, but each of the 3 large blocks had 336 cells, with 2 banks of cells, 3 stories high, each man to his own cell, a long hall running the length of the block. He noticed how the cell blocks sounded at night, how the sounds of toilets flushing masked other sounds, what time the guards made rounds, what precautions they took, how they watched, and when they didn't. He learned quickly that the prison population had figured out how to speak to one another through the sink pipes that ran through all 3 floors, and that the pipes ran behind the cells, meaning that there was space behind them. He eventually got a job in the industrial shop that crafted brooms. It was known as the brush shop. This meant he was counted in the morning in his cell, at breakfast, when he lined up for work, and when he was at work every 15-minute interval. Then all of that in reverse when the workday was done, until lights out, when the counting still continued. In the cell next to him was West, who had a job in the glove shop where they tailored gloves for sale to outside laborers. Once, Morris noticed that West was absent from his cell. He'd been sent to D Block, to the dark hole, for inciting some kind of diversion at mealtime when another guy stabbed a fellow inmate. The dark hole was, well, a dark hole. Complete darkness, concrete floors to sleep on, pot to pee in, dry spaghetti and bread for sustenance. No cigarettes, no company, just you and your thoughts. John and Clarence Anglin had arrived in late 1960 and early 1961, respectively, and went to Broadway's cell numbers 140 and 142. Morris knew John from some time they had shared in the Atlanta federal pen. Interesting. The Anglin boys, originally from the part of Florida that is almost Georgia, were not considered the sharpest knives in the drawer, but they were good followers. Talky, for sure. Too talky for Morris, maybe even for West. But the plan required them. So the best way going forward then was to unveil the plan slowly, in phases, to keep the whole thing tight. First thing they needed was something sharp, because Morris knew he was going to try to free the air vent from the back wall that was pretty well set in concrete and steel. Tough assignment. Until he noticed his fingernail clipper had that little, slightly pointed file attached. He began to see if he could, by the light of the outdoor walkway, start flaking away the damp but solid area around the air vent. He made a little headway, figuring out how to minimize the dust that he had loosened, carrying pieces of that which had chipped off in his pockets to be spread randomly around the rec yard. If this reminds you of Shawshank Redemption, well, it should. Later, such detritus would be collected and made into rough plaster with water, soap, and some glue that had found its way out of the shop. Morris soon enough improved on his little file with a spoon he had swiped from the mess. He even managed to figure out a way to weld the spoon to the file with a few matches and little notice. The three other men worked one at a time in their cells doing the same, while the others kept watch for the ever-present guards. Then they had to figure out how to hide their work on the vents. They could get their hands on cardboard and paint. They could make a replica grill with such supplies and hide what was really going on behind it. It was arduous work. The point was to see what was on the other side of that wall. Judging from looking at the structure of the cell block, Morris could see that there was some room to work with there. By fashioning a 2-foot rod that he had managed to get out of the brush shop at great peril, he measured the depth of the utility corridor behind the vent. It was enough to let a man crawl into. From there, the men could get a pipe which, when shimmied up, led to a wide open space which they would later use as a work area, where they could labor up to 90 minutes a night, assembling and storing their getaway gear. They investigated how to get off the roof and into the open air on top of the cell block. Historian Michael Esslinger.
And they make their way to the top of the cell block through that maintenance hallway by climbing up pipes to take a look at the vent that Wes has picked out for the escape. But when they get to that vent, they realize that they have a problem. The vent is bolted into place.
It would take weeks to file those bolts down. Before they could take that kind of time, though, they had to create faux heads to place on their pillows so that the guards wouldn't notice their absence. This required one of the four to take up painting. Clarence Anglin volunteered and was told to make sure to ask for black and pink paints. Someone thought it best if they collected hair that had been clipped during the occasional barbering opportunities they were given. They snuck the clippings out in the cuffs of their pants. The important thing was to get the grills off so that supplies, when gathered or assembled or painted and perfected, could be stashed so that, if cells were inspected, nothing would be found, provided no one noticed that the grills themselves were just papier-mâché fronts. When one of the Anglin boys did have his cell tossed for contraband, the robe he'd left hanging over the grill was left undisturbed. Eventually, the space behind and above cells 136, 138, 140, and 142 contained the dummy heads, the waterproof clothing detritus from the glove shop, more than 50 U.S. Navy and Marine raincoats that they'd made into life preservers, and, more impressively, into a 6-by-14-foot rubber raft. They had even secured the seams of their raft by careful sewing and by using hot steam to melt the objects into one another. You can thank all of those copies of Sports Illustrated and Popular Mechanics that they had requested from the library and scoured for information on raft building and DIY engineering, as well as for the pages of ads in them which the men had carefully sliced out so no one would notice. Those were perfect for their handicrafts. Soon enough, most everyone in the prison knew that something was up on Broadway. Inmate Ulick, who was in Alcatraz from 1955 to 1963, reinforced the idea that the prisoners offered their support and silence to the cause.
Anybody who was anybody here knew what was going on and probably helped in one way or another. I helped. I sent drill bits and hollowed out chair legs up through the metal detectors.
Everyone agreed it was almost time, but they weren't expecting it to be quite yet. But then, according to West, the Anglin boys were anxious to get out and pushed up the deadline, simply announcing that they were going. That was around 10 p.m. on the night of June 11th, 1962. With dummy heads in place, as they had been nightly unnoticed for months now, the men left via the vent and scampered up the pipes through to the troublesome air turbine and out. From there, they shimmied down the outdoor pipes, ran through shrubs, and climbed a 20-foot-tall fence topped with barbed wire to drop free on the beach below. There, they used a concertina, a kind of accordion-like musical instrument that had been recrafted to be an air pump, to inflate the raft and life preservers. Then they, without Alan West, who had waited too long to chip away some necessary boundary to his escape, put the raft into the cold Pacific and got in. According to the United States Geological Survey in more recent years, the tide was ebbing at that hour, which meant that it was flowing away from Alcatraz and the nearby refuge of the much larger Angel Island and toward the Golden Gate. From there, the current would carry anything just floating out to sea. Angel Island was a scant mile and three quarters away to the north, but paddling toward it would have been slow progress, if possible at all. And that, Alan West would later say, had been the plan. Angel Island was being decommissioned as a military base and thus had few people left on it to report seeing the men. It was certainly safer than trying to get to the city, which had lights, people, law enforcement, and virtually no cover. After they'd rested on Angel Island, he said, they would make it across to Marin County, which was less than a quarter of a mile away. There, they would steal a car. At 7:20 the next morning, when it was time for the stand-up count on B Block, the ruse was discovered. The FBI was put in charge. The Coast Guard, local police, and federal troops all began a massive manhunt in the bay and on the nearby shore. In short order, a paddle was found. 2 days later, a makeshift waterproof packet of Anglin family photos and letters were found, still dry, floating in open water. A day after that, on June 15th, a makeshift life vest was found on Cronkite Beach, which is 2.5 miles outside the Golden Gate. Another life vest was found on June 22nd, just 100 yards off the eastern end of Alcatraz Island, where water is known to swirl endlessly. Much, much later, with more than 160,000 pieces of hydrological, tide, and ocean floor data put into 21st century computers, scientists from the USGS figured the water that night was moving about 2.7 knots, or a little more than 3 miles an hour. The three men's attempts to fight the water in a raft would have been tiring and soon numbing to their extremities. Within 2 hours, they would have been forced under the bridge. Considering that they had not been professional swimmers and were of slight build, their viability in those conditions, the air temperature was 49 degrees, the water temperature around 55 degrees, was virtually non-existent. Still, even USGS senior research hydrologist Ralph Chang, who fed all that data into the computers that predicted their fate, told documentary makers that,
I am just puzzled why these three bodies were never found.
He's not the only one.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Funny thing, San Francisco police officer Robert Checkey swore that he had seen a pristine white boat out on the bay that night. He said it had no running lights, but that someone on board the boat kept shining a flashlight into the water. Police followed up on that piece of information, but it didn't go anywhere. The FBI closed the case after 17 years in 1979, feeling quite sure that the trio could not have survived the first night in the water. Which didn't mean that they and the U.S. Marshal's Office didn't give every possible consideration to any new lead that popped up. In 2013, federal prison authorities received a letter that claimed to be from John Anglin. According to CBS's San Francisco television affiliate, in a January 2018 report, the letter read in part,
"My name is John Anglin. I escaped from Alcatraz in June 1962 with my brother Clarence and Frank Morris. I'm 83 years old and in bad shape. I have cancer. Yes, we all made it that night, but barely."
According to the History Channel, John Anglin professed to be the last of the three still living, saying that the other two men died in 2005 and 2008. The letter, he wrote, was no fake. He had an offer that he'd like the FBI to consider. In exchange for a single-year jail sentence, he'd like to receive the medical treatment he so desperately needed.
"I will write back to let you know exactly where I am. This is no joke."
All the FBI had to do was announce publicly their acceptance of the one-year sentence, and he'd turn himself in. The feds did not take the deal, flatly refuting that the letter had much merit. Said National Park Service Ranger John Cantwell, quote, "The Federal Bureau of Prisons said they drowned once they got off Alcatraz and their bodies were swept out to the Pacific Ocean. End of story," end quote. Is it, though? Former Alcatraz inmate Darwin Kuhn.
"The reason I think they made it, why they got away, was because everybody else that tried to get off this island was accounted for. Those three guys are still unaccounted for today."
Anyway, the five-year wait between the time the maybe John Anglin letter was sent to the San Francisco police and when the FBI acknowledged its existence can be explained by the fact that the Bureau had been conducting a lengthy investigation into its authenticity. The FBI reported that fingerprint and DNA analysis on the writing and on the paper the letter was written on both proved inconclusive. And just when the cold case was determined to still be, well, super cold, in 2015, a photograph showed up of two men, ostensibly the Anglin brothers, taken in 1975 in Brazil. A man named Fred Breezy, who had known the brothers since they were all young together in Florida, bumped into them at a bar there. He reported that the two men had a farm and were doing well. They allowed him to shoot the picture, he said, though both men were wearing sunglasses in the shot, hindering possible identification. It's said that experts in photo analysis disagree about whether the pair are, in fact, John and Clarence Anglin. The Anglin family, represented by their nephews Ken and David Widner, even maintained that a third brother, Al, was beaten to death by the FBI during an interrogation because they knew that he knew where John and Clarence were. Now, there was a third brother, and officially Al died a year after the Alcatraz prison break while he was trying to escape from Kilby Correctional in Alabama. He was hung up on some electrical wires on his way out. In 2016, the ABC News affiliate in Fresno reported that Supervisory Deputy U.S. Marshal Michael Dyke, the chief in charge of the Oakland office of the U.S. Marshal Office, is the single lawman still on the case. He acknowledged that a man, wishing to clear his conscience, made a deathbed confession to his nurse. That man is said to have contended that he and another guy were waiting in a boat on the bay that night, and they successfully found and hauled the trio aboard. He said the boat had been painted white just a few days before they set sail on their prison errand. Now is where it gets a tad weird. This bit of information, you probably have already noted, jibes with what police officer Checkey reported in 1962. Checkey, who was still alive in 2016, was found by a Fresno TV reporter who corroborated the story, saying he was interviewed repeatedly by the FBI but they weren't buying his story. Now retired, Chucky said he regrets not calling the Coast Guard immediately. If he had, this whole line of speculation could have been long over. Now the tad weird is about to become real weird as we go back to the deathbed confessor for a small addendum. He said in his rather lengthy confession of how he helped the trio skedaddle in that pristine white boat all the way to Seattle, that the two rescuers then murdered the convicts, burying their bodies by a highway. What the heck? They got away but are dead anyway? They didn't get in a boat and are dead anyway? Or they got away and lived happily ever after? If the men had lived, it's likely that Frank Morris parted company with the brothers as soon as he was able. He had always considered them to be loudmouths. Now, also in 2016, three Dutch scientists decided to science the shit out of this thing. Rolf Hutt, Olivia Hose, and Fedor Bart fed all the weather data they could find and factored in the peculiarities of the bay around the island. The computer simulations were promising. Bart told the Guardian newspaper, quote, "If they left between 2300 hours and midnight, there's a good chance they reached Horseshoe Bay north of the Golden Gate," end quote. The three scientists even put themselves in rafts made of used raincoats and paddled around a bit. They deemed the exercise a limited success, ultimately concluding that it's, quote unquote, doable. Okay, but did they do it? If they escaped, Morris would be 98 now. It's notable that his Wikipedia entry has no date for his death. Taking a look at an ancestry family tree for the Anglins, Clarence is reported, I guess by the family, to have died in North Dakota in 2011 at the age of 80. His brother John is said to have died when he was 32 off the coast of San Francisco. I would say I'm confused by this incongruity, but that would be silly. I think they lived. In infamy, if nothing else. In researching this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read J. Campbell Bruce's Escape from Alcatraz, the first of many books which covered the same territory. Bruce was a feature writer at the San Francisco Chronicle at the time, and the book was first published in 1963. She watched a lot of documentaries on the escape attempt, each offering small tidbits and fresh news about the ongoing drama. And yes, she's been to Alcatraz. Twice. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.
I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. So you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.